We don't see any scenario where there is an oversupply of good quality industrial space in Europe in the next 5 to 10 years. And so we have been investing really meaningfully in that opportunity. We think it's going to be exacerbated by some of the global trends that we're seeing around onshoring and reshoring. These geopolitical issues, you know, have really profound implications for supply chains in European markets, and corporates and governments recognize the fragility of those and are investing to solve those problems.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Christo Nikolic, Global Head of Real Estate at ICG. ICG is a private markets-focused multi-strategy manager that's a FTSE 100 business and manages nearly $100 billion of capital on behalf of around 650 LPs globally. ICG manages mostly private, closed-end, traditional private equity funds that are focused on either real estate credit or real estate equity, with a focus on sectors and markets where there's a competitive and structural advantage when it comes to their products. On today's episode, we discuss Christo's career and specifically the lessons he learned helping to build and lead TPG and Starwood's European businesses, the transformation of European platform investing, and the state of the European markets. I enjoyed my discussion with Christo and know you will as well. Let's get into it. Christo, welcome to the show.
Brandon, thanks for having me.
For our listeners who haven't had the chance to know you, can you introduce yourself and your company, please?
Sure. I'm Christo Nikolic. I'm the global head of real estate at ICG.
And so before we get into ICG, which is a very large firm that some of our listeners in Europe and Asia and the Middle East are probably very familiar with, and maybe our real estate friends in North America are becoming increasingly familiar with. So before we go there, let's talk a little bit about your career. How did you get into the real estate business?
Well, this is a slightly harrowing thing to say, but it's now my 20th year of investing in European real estate, always within larger real estate private equity shops. But I really got here quite by accident. I grew up in a small, very small community in Scotland that won't be obvious from my name, which is Yugoslav, and we'll come on to that in a second. But grew up in a small town in Scotland where the concepts of working in finance, never mind real estate private equity, were certainly alien. And my parents were small town entrepreneurs. They had a series of businesses. One was a manufacturing business. They actually manufactured window blinds, believe it or not. And later in life, the family turned its hand to small time real estate development. And so that was my first introduction to what real estate could be as either an entrepreneurial venture or in any way a way of making money. And it was always around the dinner table, to some degree. You know, there was always conversations about tenants and leasing and ever-increasing building costs, but I never really thought that it would be a career. I left Scotland to go to university at Cambridge. I was the first of my family to make it to university education. Folks up till that point had been more focused on building businesses, working locally, and I flew the coop to some degree and went down to start life at Cambridge. And it was only really then that I, you know, began to understand what working in investment banking or the broader arena of finance might be. My parents thought I was totally crazy thinking about going to work in the city as it was at the time and working 100-hour weeks, but I decided to do it and I ended up taking my first job at Goldman Sachs back in 2004. First as an M&A banker and then focused on real estate investing there. And at that time, got to know one of the groups that were really an early pioneer in real estate private equity investing, at least in Europe. And it was a business that at the time was called Apollo Real Estate, which became Area Property Partners and is actually now Ares Management's real estate business led by Bill Benjamin. But at the time, back in the mid-2000s, was really a boutique and quite small and quite nimble real estate investment shop, typically making small value adds investments in Europe, but was at the, I think at the time, at the leading edge of some of the higher octane investing that was happening in the real estate community at that point in time. And I got to know the team whilst I was at Goldman Sachs, and I joined them in late 2005 as a very green analyst. I think it took me about 18 months to figure out, you know, what the true definition of a yield was. But it was a really fantastic basis for learning the industry, learning the both the finance aspects, but also the real estate aspects. And so that was the first job there, working for a guy called Bill Benjamin, who now, as I say, runs Ares Real Estate's business globally. And it could not have been a better training ground for entering the profession.
That's amazing. And so many people have had these great mentors. Before we get into the rest of your career, because I know you've had stops at many names that our listeners will recognize, I want to go back to the small town in Scotland. And when you talk about your family's business being, you know, small scale, local real estate, what did that mean? Were they building shop houses or small, you know, effectively townhomes for the local residents? Or what did that look like?
Well, it's fascinating because this was at a time before industrial and logistics became even close to the sexy asset class in the sector. You know, if you go back 15, 20 years, as you might remember, you know, owning industrial units was absolutely the less desirable of the four or five categories of investing in real estate. But what was clear was that the local community needed low-cost manufacturing space. They needed, in some cases, you know, low-cost retail space and a way of housing the myriads of services and ventures that exist in mid-sized towns. And so my father, who'd made a little bit of money in manufacturing, channeled that capital into buying defunct industrial space, renovating it and letting it out to the local community. And that turned out to be a really nice business. But these were, you know, this was not institutional real estate. These were small units. If there were leases in place, they weren't much more than a handshake in nature. And the tenants really were, you know, spanning the spectrum of everyone from Amazon on one hand through to the, you know, the local tattoo shop on the other hand, and kind of everything in between.
Did you ever have the temptation to, or was it ever expected of you to stay behind and maybe build on this local business? Or how did you get from the small town to be the first person in your family to leave to go to Cambridge nonetheless?
So it's always easier in hindsight to pick apart where what took you down that path. I was academic, you know, I always had a interest in pursuing more meaningful academic work. And that's what drove me to explore, at least trying to get into Cambridge, and was lucky enough to get him. And beyond that, I knew that really the small town life in Scotland was comfortable and familiar, but likely to be over a period of time not sufficiently challenging or exciting for me. And so it was an upheaval. It was definitely an emotional upheaval to leave the family behind and go and do all that stuff, but it felt like the right thing to do at the time. And I had multiple options to come back and do that after university education, but got on the track at Goldman and never looked back.
Never looked back. And so when you were at Cambridge, what did you think you were going to study? How did you think about your academics?
So I was definitely an atypical academic background for working in finance. So I studied initially political theory at Cambridge, which at Cambridge is a dense subject. And not particularly applicable for real life politics is a different issue. And so that really wasn't a good preparation for anything finance or business oriented. And then I did a final year at the Judge Business School at Cambridge, which I think apart from anything was Cambridge's recognition that they had these really bright kids who, you know, were book smart, but knew absolutely nothing about the real life of a real world approach to business. And so it was a bit of a training ground, a final year preparation for the folks who were going to Goldman and McKinsey and some of these other places. So I did that for a year. I played an awful lot of sport. I had an awful lot of fun. I was a distinctly average performer academically at Cambridge, but look back on my time there with a lot of fondness.
That's amazing. And it sounds like Goldman came, were they recruiting at Cambridge at the time? Is that how you got introduced to the investment banking world in Goldman Sachs?
That's right. So they had, you know, pretty detailed on-campus recruitment. I didn't know what it was to be an M&A banker. It took me probably 6 months being in the job before I knew what it was to be an M&A banker, but they came on campus. They actually took a fairly detailed and pretty disciplined approach to their recruiting. And I think hired 9 or 10 kids out of Cambridge that year, which was much less than they typically would have. But this was, as you may remember, the heyday for investment banking. So this was pre-GFC, 3 or 4 years before. Goldman were right at the very top of some of the mega M&A transactions that were happening, both on the corporate side and on the buyout side. And it just seemed like a super exciting place to be. So I joined initially in the UK M&A team, so advising UK corporates. Interestingly, partly because the Scottish school system is a little bit different and partly because I was young for my year, I ended up joining Goldman at age 20. So I went to the training that Goldman put all of the analysts through in New York. And for the first 7 or 8 weeks there, I couldn't buy a beer. I was under 21. So I had to get the other analysts at Goldman to buy me drinks at the bar.
Wow, that's incredible. So you started at Goldman and then you moved to Apollo. How long were you at Goldman before you moved to Apollo?
I did the standard 2-year analyst program. So I moved fairly quickly. So I joined Apollo in 2006. Apollo at the time, I think we're on fund 2. It was a reasonably small fund. There was maybe only 8 or 9 of us in the office at the time. So we were in, you know, a really small office in Chelsea in London. And, you know, it was not the institutional shop that it is today at all. You know, much smaller feel, small fund sizes. The transactions were much smaller than anything we see in the marketplace today. So joined there just as they were raising their second fund.
Okay. And what year did you leave Apollo and where did you leave to go?
So I was there for 6 years. I left in 2012 and I joined TPG as its first dedicated real estate hire in London. So post the GFC, TPG very astutely recognized that the dynamics in the real estate space allowed for new market entrants to come in and take share away from the incumbents. KKR made the same assessment and so pushed quite heavily into initially investing their large cap buyout fund in some real estate investments and then at the urging of some of their LPs raising dedicated real estate vehicles. And the team's predominant focus, at least initially, was in the United States, but then quite quickly moved to Europe, recognizing the dislocation that existed in Europe post the GFC. And so I joined 2 years after the real estate program had started at TPG.
Kind of summarize what the real estate market was like. So you had, you know, groups like probably local groups, you had groups like Apollo, who you described as very nimble, at least in the beginning. And then you had these large global buyouts like KKR, like TPG coming in. What was the market dynamic like back then in 2012?
You know, it was fascinating because I think it really heralded a really pronounced change in who the main market participants were. And I think prior to the GFC, propcos, you know, much more institutional funds, high net worths, those were the predominant market players, at least in Europe. And post the GFC, I think recognizing the investing opportunity that existed in this enormous asset class, the largest buyout groups on the planet decided to position for that opportunity. And so a few things happened. One was Europe became flooded with American private equity and other types of alternative capital. And it wasn't just the buyout groups. You'll remember that a number of the large hedge funds and some of the more distressed credit funds spent a lot of time in Europe picking over the bank distress that existed in Europe post the GFC. And so you would see, you know, the BA business class flight down to Madrid on a Monday morning, there would be 12 rows of private equity, distressed credit and hedge funds taking up the entire space, believing that they could go down to Madrid and Barcelona and value invest in that space. So I think the compositional shift in the marketplace was, you know, really significant. I think the other really meaningful shift that we saw was that the US firms recognized that often the best way to own real estate, the best format to own real estate, was in platform or corporate format. And that existed in spades in the United States, but it really didn't exist in Europe. And so what we've seen in response to, you know, what I broadly call the Americanization of some of the capital formation in Europe, we've seen a really big spring up in private company real estate and private platform real estate in Europe. And that's been a really big driver of what some of these big shops have driven in Europe over the last decade or so.
And I know we're going to talk more about this, but since we're on it right now, it seems to me that this idea of platform investing came to Europe in a meaningful way long before it came to the US. Do you have a sense of why that is? Was it the opportunities weren't large enough in Europe, and so you needed to do platform investing to scale? Was it the amount of capital was too much, or the type of capital, this buyout private equity style, you know, money that was looking for opportunities? Do you have a sense of kind of how we ended up in a situation in Europe where platform investing became prevalent so early on?
I think it was driven by a few factors. One was the recognition that consolidating assets into large scale portfolio or platform formats can often be just efficient economically. But they're easier to run, they're more efficient to run, you can create economies of scale in the management. The second was that the Europe was underserved, both from a strategic perspective and in a public company setting. It was underserved in these types of platform formats. So if you look at the REIT universe in the United States as an example, we think it's 40 or 50 times larger than what exists in Europe. And so if you are looking to get public markets exposure to European real estate, it's a very challenging thing to do in any sort of scale. And so a bunch of us recognized that and endeavored to build these businesses that could either be taken public or indeed sold to strategics, you know, often global sovereigns who just didn't have an asset base in Europe, but really didn't have the desire to build it themselves and believed that we could be paid strategic premiums to deliver that to them, which played out actually over the last decade or so.
So you joined TPG in 2012 as the first hire. How long were you there, and kind of what was the evolution of your tenure at TPG?
So I was there from 2012 to 2018 and joined as a VP and left as a partner of the business, and saw, you know, really meaningful growth over that period of time. TPG went from, you know, a new market entrant, a very powerful one, and one with, you know, great backing from a capitalization perspective, to being, I think, one of the leading lights in the sector. And it was a great, great investing environment during that 6-year period. You know, we were coming out of the GFC, but it's interesting, if you go back and you look at the opportunity set really wasn't there in scale until 2011 or 2012. So you had 3 years post the GFC, but actually the big investing opportunity started in 2011 or 2012.
Why was that?
I think the market was just so dislocated for a period of time that the constituents in the market that were the most distressed and dislocated, in many cases, the large banks, it just took themselves a while to know where everything was. They didn't know where the bodies were buried. They didn't actually know what their exposure was. And so the analysis of that took a bit of time, and then getting organized to actually start to trade out of some of these positions just took time for that to work its way through the system.
There were some really interesting buying opportunities before 2012, but the volume just wasn't there.
And it's, you know, we'll maybe talk about it in a second, but there's a lot of similarities to how we're seeing the market right now. But starting in 2012, we saw, you know, large scale bank recaps, a lot of NPL portfolios coming out of the banks, other corporate distress that was leading to really interesting opportunities to buy assets at great prices.
And then, as we talked about earlier, this ongoing ability to consolidate in the market, which, regardless of the underlying pricing, was just an interesting opportunity in itself.
Is there a kind of seminal investment that you made during that period? Sometimes, you know, investments represent the period of time. Was there something that you all did at TPG that kind of represents the opportunity that the market was presenting itself during that period of time?
There were a number both in Europe and in the United States. In Europe, we undertook, you know, a pretty broad range of investing, always with a repricing or dislocation or corporate recap theme, underlying theme to it. But coming out of the GFC, there were a number of broken CMBS structures that in Europe that needed to be recapitalized. And there were a series of transactions that required capital either to
recapitalize the existing structure or just sufficient pressure in the system that meant the CMBS note holders had to trade out of the underlying real estate. So one example is we bought this just fantastic central London office asset right in the heart of the city of London that should never have traded to an opportunistic buyer. And we were only able to secure it because we were able to work with a pretty complicated CMBS structure and work through the resolution to that drove the asset out into a sales process that we controlled.
That was a single asset transaction, but a very large one, I think around £300 million at the time. Another transaction that was super interesting was the build of a business called P3 Logistics. This was a business that actually was owned by a Bahraini financial sponsor that went into financial distress. And it was a New York bankruptcy, actually, ultimately. But that spilled a collection of really interesting European logistics assets out into our ownership. And we used that as the basis for a broader business build
that ultimately became 2.5 billion euros of logistics assets across Europe. And that business was acquired by GIC in 2016.
And that was a really interesting combination of, you know, what TPG was fundamentally good at, which was finding a situation where the day one transaction was very deep value, but where the firm's business building capabilities were brought to the table and making it something more over a period of time.
Both by improving the operations of the underlying business, but also conducting bolt-on M&A to build the business. And then, as you'll remember, during that 2012 to 2018 period, the UK saw the results of the Brexit vote. And so that imposed on the UK just, you know, a period of really high pressure dislocation. And we did a number of transactions buying from distressed owners post the Brexit vote, where it seems like a very long time ago now, but the market was in complete disarray after that event. And it really took 18 months for the market to figure itself out.
Fascinating. Yes, Brexit does seem like a long time ago, but I guess it's not long ago. So in 2018, you decided to leave TPG to join Starwood. Talk to me a little bit about that decision to make a switch, and let's talk about what you were able to do while you were at Starwood.
So it was incredibly challenging to make that decision to go. You know, I'd helped build that business at TPG, but more importantly, had developed, you know, some of the really best professional relationships I've ever had. The gentleman who ran TPG's real estate business at the time, continues to run it today, was a guy called Kelvin Davis. And he was, you know, a really fantastic leader of that business. I learned a lot from him. He, apart from anything else, probably the best communicator I've ever seen in my entire life. So the decision to leave TPG for a number of reasons was, you know, super challenging. But I was offered the job to go and run Starwood's European real estate business. And so that felt like a step up for me in terms of advancing my career. It was already a big business in Europe and one that was poised to grow even more quickly. And so joined there at the beginning of 2018 to look after what was initially a opportunistic strategy, investing the global opportunistic funds, but as Starwood's product range diversified and some of their Core Plus products came on stream as well, we're investing Core Plus capital as well. And Starwood, obviously, is, you know, you and your listeners will know, has, you know, really significant reach globally. It did in Europe at that period of time. And so we were investing in everything from UK industrial through to Finnish residential. And, you know, there were a couple of really interesting take private situations that I led whilst I was there. So that was starting in 2018, even as the markets were getting, I think, toppy and pricing was getting a little uncomfortable. You know, it was a really interesting place to be as an investor.
So, you know, kind of similar question to the TPG question, but kind of what represented the period of time when you were at Starwood? Was it the take privates, or how did you think about kind of value investing in a toppy market from 2018 to 2022-ish?
It was certainly a tougher proposition. You know, if you think about 2012 onwards, it's slightly unfair to say you could have invested in anything and made money, but it's kind of true. Right. You know, yes, certain asset classes outperformed other asset classes, but there was a rising tide there that
really delivered stellar returns for anyone who was an illiquid, levered acquirer of practically any security in the world. In 2018, it was tougher. Rates had, you know, in Europe got to practically zero. And that had driven cap rates down to really uncomfortable levels. And it meant that as an investor, you had to do one of two things really well. One was have super high conviction on asset class outperformance, and that had to be based on, you know, really deep fundamental analysis around demand and supply. And so you had to really believe in rental growth to justify paying such tight cap rates. And at Starwood, we found that in industrial and residential purchases. And so, you know, if rents are going up 15-20% a year, you can pay a 5 cap for something. It works. And so we made a series of those investments, and those were successful. The second was finding investments where largely the market was unable to play. You know, the traditional buyers and sellers in the market weren't participating. And we found a number of those situations in the public markets. So the public markets in Europe are very, very different to the United States. They are much less liquid. When they become irrational, they become heavily irrational from a pricing perspective. And often they're of a size and a complexity that is available for acquisition. And so we did a few medium-sized take privates that were very successful. And of course, there are buyers for public companies, but there are many fewer buyers for public companies than there are for a bog standard industrial building.
So you spent, what, 3.5 years at Starwood and then departed for your current role at ICG. Let's talk about that transition from Starwood to ICG.
So, you know, it took me a bit of time to contemplate leaving Starwood. I joined there, you know, it was just under 4 years before, but, still felt like a new job to some degree. And I had a really comfortable, well-capitalized position. You know, Starwood can raise money. It's a brand that is recognized globally. And so the job there was, you know, a very good one as an investor. You know, you were able to express your views as an investor quite easily, nimbly. But ICG was, for me, an opportunity to do a few things. One was to help build a business that was a little earlier in its evolution. The firm had enormous ambition and had already grown to, I think at the time, $80 or $85 billion on the corporate side of the business, but its real assets business and its real estate business was a little bit further behind. But there was a clear commitment to building that business into a market leader. The second was that, you know, as a European, I wanted to work for a European shop. And so the infrastructure and the market connectivity at ICG in the European marketplace is really second to none. You know, we have 8 European offices, 250 staff, I think, today. And I thought that that would be a really interesting backdrop for continuing to build a real estate business. And so I joined in late 2021, I have to get my dates correct, as global head and CIO of our real estate business. And since then, we have been building the business incrementally across both real estate credit and real estate equity. And we've actually started to build our business internationally as well. So despite what I said about our European specialism, our business is global and we're starting to think about how we extend our real estate business to other parts of the world. We now have teams on the ground in both Singapore and in Sydney, and we've made investments now across Japan, Korea, and Australia. And so that international growth is quickly becoming a big focus for us.
So I was really surprised when we first connected to learn about the scale of ICG. For our listeners who maybe aren't based in Europe or haven't come across ICG before, let's just take a few minutes and kind of paint the picture of what is, or I won't say who, but like, how would you describe ICG to somebody who's hearing about it for the first time?
So we are a private markets focused multi-strategy manager. I think the firm has flown under the radar relative to some of its larger peers, although that is changing, I think, quite quickly. We manage today around $100 billion of capital on behalf of around 650 LPs globally, and have been doing this in Europe initially and in globally since the early 90s. So we've been around a long time. Interestingly, the firm is was one of the earliest to be a publicly listed manager. So today we are listed on the London Stock Exchange. We're a FTSE 100 business. And our shareholders have been with the business for a long time. So, you know, we're widely distributed. We've been, as I say, trading on the LSE for 30 years.
And I think it was really just us and 3i, if you go back that far, that were, you know, publicly traded alternative managers, that the business initially was focused on corporate credit. And so if you look at its first, you know, 15 years or so of existence, ICG stands for Intermediate Capital Group. And the intermediate comes from a focus on credit investments up and down the capital structure. And so, you know, we had a very large mezzanine finance business, continue to have a very large mezzanine finance business. And that focus on corporate credit is, I think, what the firm is best known for. But the firm's diversified what it does into a whole host of other strategies in the last 5 or 6 years.
So now that you're at the helm and you mentioned, you know, maybe had flown under the radar historically, but not anymore, kind of let's talk a little bit about ICG's real estate platform as it exists today. And then, you know, maybe where you hope to continue to evolve it going forward.
So today we are a team of around 55 professionals across London, Paris, Singapore, and Sydney. We have a series of mostly private, closed-ended, traditional private equity funds that are focused on either real estate credit or real estate equity. We've been very careful about creating what we see as a competitive and structural advantage when it comes to our equity products. And we've primarily focused on European sale and leasebacks and triple net lease investing. And what you'll see in that is a continuation of the credit ethos that's in all of our investments.
A real focus on underwriting single name credit risk and the downside protection that comes with a very heavy underwrite of that.
And that is now our single biggest strategy in our real estate equity space. And we are the largest private fund investor in sale and leaseback and triple net leases in Europe today.
Interesting. And is the sale, leaseback, and triple net market in Europe the same as it is in the US, or are there differences? And that might be a dumb question, but I just want to make sure we hit on it.
It's not a dumb question. And if it had been similar to the US, we would have probably shied away from leaning into that strategy as aggressively as we have. And the differences are several fold. One is that the sector is much less mature. There aren't too many specialist firms focused on that space.
In the US, it's a very established asset class in its own right. In Europe, it's a small part of a broader asset class. And the market is really getting to grips with what it means to be a triple net lease investor in Europe.
The second is that the investable universe is quite different and we think more attractive. The reason for that is that
owner-occupiers in Europe own a disproportionately high amount of the real estate. So over 60% of institutional real estate in Europe is held by non-real estate institutions, often by large corporates. And what we're seeing is both a structural and cyclical shift towards those corporates rationalizing their balance sheets. Sometimes they're looking to recapitalize themselves. Sometimes they're just looking to do something strategic. And that's causing them to trade their real estate to us. And so the investable universe in Europe is just enormous. We've been able to develop really significant relationships with a very large number of European corporates. And for various reasons, they just don't want to own their real estate anymore. And we are the first point of call for when they're looking to trade on some of that asset base. And what's really fascinating is that the trick is in the name, the triple nets. Triple net is a unusual lease structure to achieve in Europe. Most assets have some element of cash flow leakage in them for the landlord. So what we're creating in our portfolios of these triple nets in Europe is actually quite differentiated. When people look at the European marketplace and they see our portfolio, it's cleaner from a cash flow perspective than what's generally on offer.
when you think about the corporate owned real estate, so are you then taking the, are you investing in this real estate that's being spun off directly, or are you doing so through kind of specialist managers that, you know, might help kind of with local market knowledge? I can imagine, you know, sitting here in the United States, Europe is a big place. You know, it's not, you can't paint it with a single brush. So what might be happening in the Nordics could be very different than what's happening in, you know, Spain or Germany. So how do you think about all the different market dynamics and the need to understand and underwrite this single tenant credit risk? Because on one hand, you know, there's a huge advantage that you have with your credit business and underwriting it. On the other hand, it is single tenant and there is credit risk, right? So how do you kind of rationalize these things?
So by and large, we do the management ourselves. We do the aggregation and the management ourselves. We think that that is the business proposition to the outside world, that we can take the investment opportunity from the initial underwrite, which can often be quite a complex underwrite, all the way through to the eventual management of the assets. And you're right to note that there is jurisdictional complexity. Again, that's a barrier to entry that I think supports our business proposition, because landlord rights in Germany are very different to landlord rights in France and very different to landlord rights in the UK. And so when you role play, when you simulate what's going to happen in these single tenant situations, they're very jurisdiction specific. And you have to have the experience of working through those creditor complexities in those markets. Otherwise, you can't be in that strategy. In addition, you know, the relationships that are necessary with European corporates are typically national ones. You know, it's quite tricky to, you know, arrive in Europe in your first year and have a deep-rooted relationship with a mid-market German corporate. That's just a tough, tough thing to do. It takes a while to build these relationships. And so we've built that up over a fairly long period of time, and typically have to have local language skills internally. You've got to have people on the ground. You've got to have people who understand the customs. And that's just a bit different to what you see in the US market.
Am I right in thinking that an advantage that you have in addition to the jurisdictional understanding is the fact that the listed company's primary business is corporate credit, and that's how you get access to some of these opportunities? I think you mentioned before you're often the first call when there is a situation where a corporate needs to spin off their real estate or some assets that they own.
Yeah, it works to our advantage in a number of ways. The first is, as you say, often we have really deep-rooted relationships with these corporates already. You know, we may not be a financier to them, but we will know the management team, we'll know their industry, we'll know the key players. And that drives a lot of deal flow to our business, to our real estate business. The second is in the underwrite. So when you're underwriting these single name credits, obviously you're not underwriting them in isolation. The individual business's performance is important, but so is the broader market backdrop, the sector that they're operating in, their competitive set. And typically we will have done the work in that space already, and that allows us to be a more nimble, faster counterparty for some of these corporates who sometimes are looking to raise cash quite quickly. And the third is this point around, you know, having a track record of doing it more than once. You know, when we're dealing with corporates, very often they are corporates that are in some period of transition. They may be in transition as it relates to their balance sheet. You know, they're going through a recap. They may be in the middle of an M&A process. They may have a call from their parent company to say, go asset light. They have some strategic or financial challenge that they're solving by working with us on their real estate. And so you've got to be flexible. You've got to be solutions oriented. You've got to be a partner with them. You cannot be a cold institutional landlord. That would never work in the strategy. I mean, now I have a track record of, you know, 50 or so transactions of showing to these corporates that we know how to do all of those things.
So when you invest in real estate, are you doing so out of the discretionary funds or are you doing so from your balance sheet as a corporate?
It's nearly always into our discretionary funds. So we have a series of purpose-built funds that are focused purely on the strategy. The traction from LPs as the strategy has grown over the last few years has been good.
Interestingly, we've been a broad-based pan-European investor. So we've invested now in 14 or 15 European countries. But increasingly, we're seeing merit in being quite geographically focused. And our activities right now are really focused on Western Europe.
So for the avoidance of doubt, when you talk about your teams in Asia and transacting, are they doing that out of European vehicles that have a broader remit? Or how do you think about your international footprint from both where you have offices and where you're actively investing today?
And so Asia is earlier in its process, and we didn't touch on this earlier, but one of the really interesting and powerful features of ICG's investing program is its ability to incubate and support strategies through balance sheet investments early in their evolution as an investment management franchise. And so in Asia, our early investments there in Japan, Korea, and Australia have all been made off our balance sheet. And the intention there, as with all of our newer franchises, is to prove track record, prove the performance of the underlying teams and investments.
Interesting. And do you have anything in the US, or is that maybe down the road?
Well, it's interesting. I think I would be very surprised if I was on this podcast 2 years from now, I wasn't talking about three continents rather than two. So we have absolute intention to be there. Again, to my point earlier, you know, I have a bit of a bugbear that, you know, any new real estate franchise and strategy today has to have a very clearly defined competitive and structural advantage. There are too many really great incumbents there that you don't want a me too strategy. And so one of the things we're thinking about in the US market is, you know, certainly seems a little bit less competitive than it was. You know, some of the space I think is perhaps dealing with more legacy issues than they did before, and maybe people are a little bit less on the front foot. And so that could be an interesting entry point for us. But we're thinking about it quite carefully before we get to the jump off point.
Well, if you want any ideas, I'm happy to brainstorm. One that I'll share proactively is I do think that there's a lot of real estate sponsors who are pretty high quality sponsors in the US who are struggling on the corporate side, and corporate credit to opcos in the US would certainly be a way to hoover up a lot of assets very quickly with some great operators locally. So we'll watch this space and see what a few years looks like from now. Let's spend the last few minutes together just talking about the European markets, because you have such history there and deep specialty. How would you describe kind of this moment in time? And we're recording this in the fall, in September of 2024. What's happening in Europe, or across Europe, I should say, right now, as the world kind of emerges post-COVID? We've been from a pretty high interest rate environment to very recently signals of a much lower interest rate or a lowering of interest rate environment. What are the dynamics on the ground?
So I think the first thing to say is it's just incredibly difficult to paint with a broad brush in Europe. You know, the individual countries do tend to operate quite idiosyncratically, both from a macroeconomic perspective and a real estate market perspective. But in general terms, Europe has largely managed to avoid, you know, what was feared to be a very deep recession, but it's still a sluggish market backdrop. But that's been the case in Europe for a while, right? I mean, Europe is a market for dislocation and deep value. It is not a market that's going to compete with the United States in terms of growth in most cases. But the worst recessionary outcomes, I think, have largely dissipated. And these economies are doing okay, but not great. What's really interesting is if you dive into the individual features of each of these economies, you know, they all have different opportunities and threats. You know, if you take Germany as an example, Germany 24 months ago was the darling of global real estate markets. You know, you had ultra low interest rates and therefore ultra low cap rates. You had an economy that was fiscally very sound. You know, it was right in the heart of Europe, great export markets to China, cheap oil and gas from Russia, very, very competitive as an economy. That largely has all gone away in the space of 24 months. And that is, you know, a tough reckoning for those that owned assets prior to the downturn. It's a really interesting opportunity going forward. Pricing has reset incredibly. You know, 4 and 5 caps are now 7 and 8 caps. But the constituencies that are really feeling the economic challenges, you know, they don't immediately bubble to the surface. You have to be in that market and go looking for them. And so, you know, one example is we're spending an awful lot of time in the sale and leaseback space. So as German corporates face financial challenges, one of the things that they're turning to is realizing the real estate that's on their balance sheet. And we've been as we spoke about earlier, a big provider of that capital. In the UK, the market is very different. You have less of that corporate challenge. But in the UK, as many of your listeners will have read about, the open-ended and core funds apparatus has largely disintegrated. And so the body of investors that dominated the UK marketplace for much of the 5 or 6 years have just disappeared. And so it's this fascinating opportunity to go and replace their capital with our capital, which ultimately means we're often buying core plus assets, but at completely different pricing. And they've been the biggest sellers of assets in the marketplace in the last 12 to 18 months. And they've been a really interesting place to invest. So you really have to pick apart the individual markets to talk about what's happening. I think, though, if you compare and contrast it, you know, with the US, which is one of the questions we get from our investors very often, one of the most important aspects of the market is that supply has just always been chronically low in Europe. So, you know, we're now 15 years after the GFC. We think that the market has been undersupplied in grade A space in most metropolitan markets in Europe for that 15-year period. And of course, sitting here today, you'd have to be a pretty brave developer to, you know, put a lot of additional exposure on the books today. And so we roll the clock forward another 4 or 5 years. And we think that there would be, you know, structural undersupply in the European markets for close to 2 decades. And that just gives a really solid backbone to the market. And we believe that, you know, in the next 3 or 4 years, in certain asset classes, there's a really interesting opportunity for rental growth in some of these more undersupplied markets.
So that's a great way to shift for the last kind of few minutes of our conversation. Where do you see those pockets of most immense undersupply juxtaposed against population growth, economic expansion, et cetera? Kind of what are some of the highlights that you're seeing where you and your team are going to spend more time, maybe in addition to Germany, which you previously touched on?
So I think it's most pronounced in the broad category of European logistics, industrial, and supply chain infrastructure. If you look at the headline statistics for most major European markets, vacancy rates are 2% or below. And the projected supply curve is, you know, not significant. And so we don't see any scenario where there is an oversupply of good quality industrial space in Europe in the next 5 to 10 years. And so we have been investing really meaningfully in that opportunity. we think is going to be exacerbated by some of the global trends that we're seeing around onshoring and reshoring, these geopolitical issues, you know, have really profound implications for supply chains in European markets, and corporates and governments recognize the fragility of those and are investing to solve those problems. And so we think that there's a really interesting capitalization hole in that space generally, which some corporates are solving through sale and leaseback transactions. So that's been probably 70% of where we've deployed capital over the last period of time. We continue to be a big financier of residential and core markets. You know, as with many of the residential markets around the world, we see the twin problems of increasing urbanization and really no political will to deliver meaningful new residential supply into most European markets. And so the financing opportunity there has been really interesting. We're a very large scale, on the credit side of our business, large scale financier of residential construction. And that's been a really nice place for us to invest. Banks are, you know, more shy than they used to be on construction financing. And so we think we're able to eke out, you know, really interesting risk return in the residential finance space. Office, we don't invest in. You know, we're bearish on the global outlook for office. It is a little bit better than it is, at least in the United States, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is the working from home trends are less pronounced in Europe. And the second is this point I mentioned earlier, you know, there was just never meaningful supply in any large European office markets. But it's still hugely challenging and we're not spending much time there.
Regardless of where you invest or spending time, is there one market that you think, one market or asset class that you think is kind of under acknowledged, under covered, whether it's investable from an institutional perspective or just something that for your 20 plus years in this business, you've kind of said, why is nobody doing this for any reason? Anything super interesting to you?
I think that the stuff that falls between the cracks of corporate private equity and real estate private equity just continues to catch less of a bid than the traditional asset classes. And so particularly in certain social infrastructure spaces, whether it be in healthcare, whether it be in some of the leisure sectors, where the skill set of operating assets just means that there are fewer market participants, that continues to be a really interesting place to invest. One of our most fascinating investments in the last few years is that we bought Wembley Arena. So this is a 12,000 seat concert venue close to the larger Wembley Stadium that is this world famous. And that married this really interesting theme that we have around consumer-led experiences with a world-class bit of real estate in a sale and leaseback transaction. And that's been, you know, something that we were able to do because we were happy with both the real estate and the operating complexity of that type of event space. But there were maybe only, you know, two or three other groups in the market who were happy to own that type of real estate.
Well, I think that's a great one to end on. And now I know why you left that for the last, because I'm sure people will be asking you for special privileges and access to Wembley Arena when they see their favorite artist or sports team coming through. But Christo, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate you spending some time and educating me on what's happening in the European market and our listeners, and also telling us a little bit more about ICG. So a lot more to chat about, but alas, we're out of time. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thanks for having me on today, Brandon. I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff. Or you can find me on Twitter at @bsedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.